Welcome to another episode of the Valley Film Festival at Cinegear. We're here with another VFF alumni, Mark Terry.
That's right.
He's been in the festival three times so far, hopefully a fourth soon.
Yes, I hope so.
So the first year was in 2008.
Yes.
And then 2015, mm-hmm. And then 2016.
That's right.
So what brought you to VFF the first time?
So this is so weird, full circle here. Right to our right, your left, is Filmotechnik, the Russian arm, or now called the Ukraine. So years ago, I used to coordinate that company. I ran the entire company, and it is it's called the Russian arm back then, but they used to use it on films like Transformers. I mean, they still use it to this day. I Am Legend. So when I was working for that company back in Culver City back in 2006 and 2007, I would come to, guess where, Cinegear Expo. I ran into Tracy, we started talking, and at that point, I was using that equipment. It would go from Transformers to my film. So we're talking about before there was drones and all this stuff, car chases with this $10,000, $15,000 a day equipment on my $500,000 movie. So that's how I met her initially, was at Cinegear when I worked here for that company.
All right. And did you film shoot your film here in LA?
So the initial one, which was Live Evil, which is now being christened Samurai Priest Vampire Hunter, as it comes out in the new version in HD, hopefully next year. With that being said, that was shot in Los Angeles, all around LA, mostly in the Antelope Valley, where we did a lot of car stunts and action. Protocol New Orleans was shot in New Orleans, obviously. I mean, and then
Actually going to ask if it was shot in New Orleans or shot in LA.
No, I love LA, but for 5 years I was in New Orleans when, you know, the film. In the industry, New Orleans was number one at one point. They're not anymore, but Protocol New Orleans was in New Orleans, and then The Hero was also shot in New Orleans, and that was the last thing I did before I came back. So,
all right. It. So, totally losing my train of thought.
I'm just rambling a little bit. Yeah, it's okay.
Oh, actually, what I was going to say is I'm noticing your shirt.
Yes.
You've got, it looks like a comic book cover of Samurai Priest.
So with that, here's how it happened. When we shot Live Evil in 2000, I don't think I've ever really publicly announced this, and there's really no information except for archival articles that I've written. I've done a lot of restoration, film restoration. I'll get into that. I can get into that in a second. With that being said, the film was shot on Super 16mm and 35. So it only ever released in standard definition via Warner Brothers on VOD and Netflix streaming before Netflix ever was what it is today. So this is, you know, late 2009, early 2010. So with that being said, I had to go back and restore the entire film. Mm. When you restore an entire film and it's mostly on 16 and underlit and gritty, we realized to be able to bridge some of the story, a lot of the actors, all the actors are 14 years older. I don't have a time machine. You know, we ended up taking the comic book route, like Creepshow or Demon Knight. And that's how we were able to bridge a story, but also hide some of the underexposed film. So I've really gotten into the archival aspect of film restoration. We scanned the film on four different scanners to be able to get to the final product that it is now. So it is actually like Live Evil's kind of deleted, like the original Star Wars was, and this new Samurai Priest Vampire Hunter is like the Snyder Cut. It's completely different, new music, new visual effects. We shot 16 more days. It's 7 minutes shorter. I mean, it's got the comic book theme. It's not even really the same movie except for the basis of it. So we had to go with that comic book sound to be able to be rechristened. So it's the only time it's ever been released on HD. The old one is like virtually a rough cut compared to this.
Right.
So now maybe, you know, somebody will want to see it going forward in the future as a new HD film. Maybe a Shutter or something like that. It'd be great for them. Vinegar Syndrome. I mean, you know, I'm reaching out to everybody.
So. Well, you know, we do have the deadline for this year's festival ending in like 5 days.
Right, that's true. But that's the weird thing. It's kind of this thing where it's the basis of an old film. And, you know, you hear within the Screen Actors Guild a lot, like with the new Matrix, reuse. You know, where they had the Matrix old footage on the wall. And it's not reuse, it's kind of like a retelling. And it was the only way to retell it. So it's kind of old, but nobody's really ever seen it. And if you remember standard definition back in the day, DVD, interlaced, nasty looking video, you know what I mean? Now it's clean, 2K, 16 millimeter scans in 2K, 4K for 35. So it's gorgeous. It looks like it was shot yesterday.
Yeah.
Shot 14 years ago.
I mean, my first professional short film in 2004.
Okay.
I've been wanting to release it in, like, you know, run it through like AI to up-res it to like, you know, HD or 4K, because mm-hmm. we shot on DVR, so it was standard definition, but we also it was stretched, but the version, like the copy I have is just, it's squished in letterbox, so it's not even the full 540, because it was shot like, you know, 16:9, but on standard definition. So I don't even, like, I've been really hesitant, like, do I really want to take this, what's effectively 300 lines of resolution, and try and up-res that?
Yes.
Or do I, you know, keep searching, because I think I lost a mini DV tape somewhere.
So do you have a master of it?
I have a master that's the letterbox.
Okay. So, I mean, too bad it wasn't on film, because then it'd be an easy process just scanning it. That's the, you know, back during that era, I was always screaming at people, shoot film, and digital was so, I don't know, so sweet back then that a lot of, and
well, affordable. This was for a 48-hour film project, so right. Film might have been a little hard.
Right, well, yeah, so you couldn't have done that. But with that being said, so the main scanner that we use, and I'll get to your point, is called a ScanStation.
Okay.
There's a ton of others. Scanity, Cintel, Blackmagic Design has a Cintel, Film Fabrique, and they're all different budget levels. But ScanStation now has a, there's a gentleman that sells a ScanStation named Steve Klink. And if you don't remember it, you can watch, you know, because I know you're going to be talking to a lot of people, but Galileo Digital is the name of his company.
Okay.
He has AI that will up-res your footage.
Okay.
So this is a brand new thing that's coming out. Now, I'm not an expert on it because I've mostly shot film in my life, but anything like some of these guys that shot their movies on film but only had SD, they want to restore it as well, but that's all they have is an old, like if I didn't have the negative, but you can also do that with what you have. So either if you get my information from Tracy, I can always put you in touch with Steve Klink, but I have no idea how much that costs
right.
or what that entails, but that's a great thing going forward.
I'm even just trying to get my hands on an old mini DV deck, like an old DSR 11 or something, for not that much, and they're just really hard to find in good condition.
Have you?
Because I want to search through the tape, because I think I was stupid and put multiple things on tapes and had breaks between, so
sure.
I might be missing where on the tape it is, and I just want to search and see if I can find it.
You're going to turn into me. When you get into those tapes, you're going to want to recut it. You're going to put in new music, and then you're going to say, I need to do this. I could do this better, and you're going to turn into a George Lucas. No, but...
Well, thankfully, that project I only produced. I didn't, like, write it. I didn't edit it.
Okay.
I didn't direct it. There's a cameo of me, you know, running it, you know, from... you know, a man with a gun type of thing. But
now, let me ask you this. Have you checked out ShareGrid? Are you familiar with that?
I am familiar with that.
So
I haven't yet.
ShareGrid, you know, is like the Airbnb, and I met those guys. They're really nice guys. They actually sold the company. They used to come here, I think, if I'm not mistaken, to Cinegear. But I would check on ShareGrid and see if you can rent the mini DV deck.
Yeah.
See if anybody has it out there, like, and just go rent it for a weekend. You know,
yeah.
One-day rental over the weekend, pick it up Friday, drop it off Monday, zip right through.
Yeah, because I want to say I've got like 25, 30 mini DV tapes. Some are raw footage.
Right.
Some are edited projects. And I thought it's probably a good exercise to just go and digitize all of that.
Yeah, because those things aren't supposed to last 25 years.
I think I'm right about that edge. I'm probably about 15 years in.
Right.
So I probably should start capturing that footage now if I want it to last.
Yeah, and the archival aspect of this is very important, because you never know with your films. You never know if, you know, you continue on, or maybe, like, you know, one of the guys in your films becomes a serial killer. You know, you know what I mean?
And then all of a sudden, like, CNN's wanting to...
Everybody wants it. So I think it's always important to archive that if you can. And that I would start with ShareGrid and see if anybody's got a mini DV deck out there and try to do that. And then once you have it, go through it. The squishing you're talking about, the letterboxing, I don't know if the AI can get that done, but if you obviously had the original master, you wouldn't, it would just be up-res, it'd be a lot smoother.
I remember, I remember having a copy both letterboxed on the tape, because that's how we had to turn it in.
Sure.
But then also like, oh, well, give it to me anamorphic so that it's the full resolution.
Okay.
And that's what had gone missing. I mean, I've got like an old hard drive that went missing. And those hard drives don't last long either, right?
Yeah. You know, so some of those Seagates and those cheapo ones that I used to get, just got to keep updating them, you know?
Yeah.
It's scary.
Transfer things over. And
yep.
Yeah, and even now I've started integrating Backblaze into my process so that I've got, you know, my hard drives locally, but then there's now a copy in the cloud, which has actually helped when I haven't brought a file with me and I'm editing remotely. I'm like, oh, I need that one file.
Right.
And I can just download it into my, you know, downloads folder. You know, link it up, and then when I'm back home, I just relink it back to the hard drive.
Makes sense.
And then I can delete the local file. But it's kind of helped me a little bit in that respect, where I don't need to have as many files with me.
Sure.
But then, you know, at the same time, you know, having that offsite, so God forbid my house burns down and takes the hard drives with me.
And I think there's something's going to be happening with that. I mentioned that I don't work for Galileo. I mean, I just know them because I've been dealing with them a lot. But they are going to be doing something with one of the hard drive companies where they just back everything up and they just AI everything for you and up-res it for you. So, I mean, I'm interested in it because I've mostly shot on film, but I did do one feature on digital. And, you know, here's a great example with you with 48-hour film festival. In 48 hours, did you really get a chance to color correct it as much as you maybe wanted, or did that even exist with DaVinci Resolve back in the day?
It was colored, I think at the time it was probably like Final Cut 7.
Yeah, so you got to
Yeah,
pass,
we were working with a
know.
Full team, like that was,
right.
that they did like corporate videos all the time.
Okay, so
there is coloring, there's like visual effects even.
Wow.
There's in fact, yeah. I have to even, because the challenge was there's like one shot where there's the render glitched, and so there's a speed ramp.
Yeah.
You know, that had glitched, and instead of ramping, it like doubled the footage.
Okay.
But I'm not sure if the version that I've got had been that fixed, or like I literally just need to go back and look at the footage.
It's probably
like,
in there.
What do I even have right now?
Right.
What, you know, but I mean, I wanted to put it out for like the 15-year anniversary in 2019, and I completely missed that window, and I don't want to wait for 20 years
right.
in 2024, but, you know, I mean, it's at a point where just put it out, because it's a film that we actually did with my good friend Doug Jones.
Okay.
Of, you know, he had just done Hellboy as Abe Sapien.
Yeah.
And, in fact, he had come and done our film after a signing here in L.A., drove down to San Diego to be in the film, and then, you know, later on, he had just done Pan's Labyrinth,
right?
And I saw him and Guillermo del Toro at Comic-Con, and I went up to say hi to Dougie, and he turns to Guillermo, and he goes, "This is a very talented filmmaker.
Wow.
You know, he did a film I was in," and you know, Guillermo looked at me like, "Very nice."
Nice.
And then he like drew a little sketch of himself on my poster, which is now long gone.
It sounds like you're, I mean, like hustling these guys, some of these horror movie guys or, you know, genre guys at conventions is really the way to go. Sometimes you get a great reaction or sometimes they'll blow you off. But, yeah, that's really cool. I didn't know you had him in it. And I've never really heard of anybody working with him in an independent film. I think you're the first person, like everybody's worked with Eric Roberts.
Well, back then, everyone, like his problem is that he has trouble telling no, but now he's like so busy with Star Trek
and
everything else that he's doing, it's, you know, it's a little harder to, you know, to catch him and sit down like it used to be. But, you know,
well, that's cool though. I mean,
I've known him since 97 when the biggest thing he'd done was Hocus Pocus.
Wow. Well, I tell you what, Monsterpalooza was last week and they had Hocus Pocus there, and it was, I don't know, a gathering for that. They still got a lot of fans for that movie. I didn't know.
Right before the pandemic, I was at, was it called Freeform or ABC Family or something like that, whatever they're called at the time. They were doing some Hocus Pocus specials before Hocus Pocus 2 was announced.
Yeah.
And I think before Disney Plus launched and all that stuff.
Sure.
And it was just before Halloween, and so it was a special that they were doing that was going to then air. And so they had almost, I think, everyone but Bette Midler was there.
Right.
And, you know, of course, Doug was on stage and everyone was on stage. And it was at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery.
Okay.
And it was a huge turnout. I want to say a couple, like 200-400. Like, they packed the area of the mausoleum.
I've seen they've had those screenings there. I've never been to one. That's always kind of been one of my things on my... I don't want to say bucket list because that's probably the wrong term for that place, right? But, I've never done that. But
that's
I've always
where
seen...
I saw Casablanca for the first time.
Wow, that's a weird
And
mix.
Then the next week they were doing like Beetlejuice or something. And I'm like, I don't know how I feel about watching Beetlejuice in a cemetery.
But that seems a little bit more fitting though, maybe. I don't
right?
know. It's like, but yeah, I've been in that cemetery one time, I think with my dad and my mom. And who's in there? Peter Lorre?
I know Toto's in there.
The
dog
okay.
from, you know.
And one of the Ramones is in there or something. He's got a really nice, you know, him playing a guitar. If it's the same one, I don't know. There's a bunch of cemeteries
yeah.
like that.
Yeah, there's a few cemeteries. I know that, like, my dad's a big Laurel and Hardy and Abbott and Costello
Mel
fan.
Blanc was in there, I think.
Right.
Yeah, so yeah. Unbelievable.
Well, Laurel and Hardy are at a couple of the different ones in the valley.
Okay.
And so I went with him to see the grave of one of them. And, of course, I'm just kind of like... this doesn't, you know, do anything for me, but sure, there it is, Dad. Go enjoy.
Right.
But I had more fun when we went to check out the Music Box steps in Silverlight.
Right. Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, I love talking about the archival stuff and seeing things come back alive because, you know, those visual effects back in the day, you know, maybe that could even be updated. Maybe it's fine the way it is. You know, you don't want to go overboard, maybe like I didn't spend too much time, but, you
well,
know.
Well, it's interesting because we were talking... with the last guest, we're actually talking about that, the challenge of not being a perfectionist. You know, when you put your heart and soul into something, and basically when you create something, you're sharing a piece of your heart with the world.
Yeah, you're right.
And so you want it to be good. You want it to be the best it can be.
Yep.
But you also don't want to never release it because it's not done.
Right.
And, you know, that's
it's like
the
I've written an article about it, but I think 100 people have written an article about it. And when it comes to filmmaking, it's fast, cheap, and good. Choose two. You know what I'm talking about. Okay, I don't have to finish the sentence.
It's usually you say that to, the clients. Like, they
right.
want the world, and they're not going to pay enough. It's like, well, you need to decide. You get two of these three. Which do you want?
Right.
You want it fast and...
So
and
we,
cheap?
I always
it's
say,
not going to be good.
Well, I always say as good as humanly possible, realistically, but it's not going to be Jurassic Park, but we can make it as good as this could be. I mean, it could be much worse.
Yeah.
And then it's not going to be fast because it's cheap, you know, and in my opinion, I think cheap is under $1 million, you know, $500,000. Now there's people making micro budget. That's fine too, but it's never fast. So that's why sometimes it takes me a couple years to do something. It's just the way that it is, you know. But money equals speed. That's life. And that's what everybody's searching for, you know, to speed things up and have more names. Then you have, I was going to say Doug Jones. I'm getting horror movie people, horror folks messed up out here. But, you know, then you have him the entire time and he's on your time clock, you know, instead of somebody else's, I guess. But, yeah, you're right about that. So
what's the biggest piece of advice you'd give a new filmmaker?
Oh, geez, oh man. If I, a new filmmaker?
Yeah, someone just getting into, you know, maybe they've got a little bit of experience, but they're just really cutting their teeth and trying to find their identity in the industry.
I would say this, assume that nobody's going to help you. Assume you're on a deserted island by yourself. And whatever skill that you have or think that you have, I don't know, you might have a lot, you might have none, assume that skill's not good enough. Assume that you are going to have to learn everything. And I'm not saying you have to be a master at everything, you know, jack of all trades, master of it, nothing.
Right.
I'm certainly not a camera operator, but I can pick one up.
Right.
I'm not a...
That's how I feel about editing. I can edit, and I'm a decent editor.
Right.
But I know I'm not an editor.
Right. And I'm the thing that I'm the furthest from is I was a theater major in college. I just got into producing films because who's going to put me in a Vietnam movie? You know, who's going to put me in an action movie? Even though I've been SAG forever and done all that stuff, you know what I mean? It's just like, I needed to make these because I wanted to be in the stories that I'm interested in. So I had to learn every aspect of it. And this some of this boils down to, and a lot of people just like, I want to make the film and give it, you got to learn distribution. You have to learn, I've had to become a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer, but I've had to learn contracts and arbitration and all that
stuff. I've written all of my contracts. I've had to run it by lawyers
right.
to make sure I'm not missing things.
Right. So
I remember sending one to someone. I'm buying a script, and I'm like, here, tell me, you know, how's this look? They're like, you don't even have the clause where it assigns the copyright to you.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, the most important part of this contract.
And I think the other aspect of it, you know, I mean, it's kind of a two-part question for me, or a two-part answer, I guess, is, you know, be a jack of all trades. Imagine, like, that you're on a deserted island and nobody's going to help you. And number two is just, you have to love it. If you think you're going to become a millionaire tomorrow, you know, look at it like this, and I'll shed my heart here. I drive a piece of crap 2003 Kia Spectra, okay? Could I afford a Tesla? Sure, absolutely. But I put everything I have into my films. I'm not saying I invest 100% of the money that I have in my films, but everything. Sometimes I take off other side jobs. By the way, have a side job. Have some kind of a side hustle. I mean, that's a term now. Nobody was saying that 10 years ago. But work anywhere you can so you're not handcuffed into doing something you don't like, and then you don't even get to make your film. So, like, for, I'll give you a perfect example. I've worked in coordination, scheduling, and hotels for years, but I can come and go. You know, yeah. I've worked in scheduling in the industry. Have jobs that you can come and go at and you're not handicapped. That gives you the ability to be able to do what you love. If you think you're going to be famous or tomorrow or whatever, I got in this because I want to tell stories. And I grew up in the 80s, so I want to tell those kind of stories that I grew up. Like, yeah. I got a poster of RoboCop on my wall. That's what I like. You know what I mean? You know, Predator. Those.
You're
going to
go get a photo of yourself with the statue in Detroit when they finally unveil it?
Yes.
Apparently it's done.
Oh, is it?
They just need to find a new home for it because the museum that was going to take it decided not to.
Okay, I didn't know that. I tell you what, after spending a lot of time in New Orleans and dealing with that crime and making Protocol New Orleans because of crime, I don't know how much I'm going to hang out in Detroit. I don't know if you're from Detroit, but or anybody who's watching, but I'm trying to stay away from crime these days.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if I can.
So what are you doing here in L.A.?
Well, I'll tell you what, living on the west side, there's not as much. It's just a, you know, ratio of how much you're going to deal with. But I don't know. I think that answers your question. It's just you got to love it and just prepare to have to do everything. I mean, you're an editor. See, this is great for you because I'm more dependent on editors. And if an editor's slow or doesn't want to do it, it's not something I can sit down and do as much. I come more from...
Well, that's what I was actually talking about. I was saying, like, I can edit, but I'm not an editor.
Right.
You know, I'm a, you know, writer-director. Mm-hmm. And so I come at, you know, where, like, I like to edit what I shoot when it's a small, like, a music video.
Sure.
Or something like that. But then, you know, when it gets to the more complex stuff, like, I actually shot something the, you know, June of 2020 during the pandemic. And then it never got released because I was editing. And we got bogged. I got bogged down,
right.
You know, with the, you know, I got a rough cut that looked pretty good, and then it was like all that fine tuning, and I was needing to bring in other people. And the thing I feel like it really needs is I need an editor to come in and clean up after me.
Well, there's a good Facebook group actually called, I don't know if you're familiar with this, I Need an Editor, and I Need an Assistant Editor.
I did not know that one.
Okay, so that group, you put it out there. It's a I Need an Editor. You can look it up when you get back. But with that being said, you put it up there. Somebody will come and you say what your rate is or what they're, you know, that's how it's, that didn't exist a number of years ago. But I think the other thing that's, and this is something I mentioned me being a theater major. I graduated with a theater degree in 2001, but I also started doing stunts at the same time. So that's kind of like what my background is, but I wouldn't call myself a stuntman. But with that being said, how can you be different and be interesting?
Were you doing stunts here in L.A.?
Yeah, I've done stunts in L.A., in New Orleans. I've done in Florida.
Did you go through the Yerkes Circus?
No.
Bob Yerkes' house?
I you know what? Bob Yerkes, I have trained there before. Up in White Oak, off White Oak. And yeah, so
I lived in the RV in his driveway my first 8 months in L.A.
You know what? I think how about that? I was up there. There's a guy named Tom Morga, and I can't remember the other guy's name. He was a stunt coordinator for David Carradine. Why am I forgetting his name? He was a really nice guy to me. Not at first, but after a while. But when I got out here in 2004, by 2005, 2006, I started training there. I didn't train there a long time, but actually...
It seems almost every stunt person that goes through there.
I met him, Bob Yerkes. I think I was at his 80th birthday party, and that was 15 years ago, 20 years ago. You know, so I have trained there. I remember one time they have that Russian swing, the one that they use in the circus.
I did the Russian swing.
And I was so heavy and so awkward. I just fall over. They said, get this guy the hell out of here. You know, put somebody else up there. But, yeah.
I would do, like, when I would fly off the Russian swing, I'd be like, ah! They're like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I don't know.
I'm trying it.
They're like, wait, are you trying to be a stunt person? I'm like, no, this is kind of my workout.
Right, yeah.
Like, I just, like, this is social for me.
So many people have come through there. But actually, and ironically, as we sit right here in Staples Center, cryptocurrency is right next to us to our left. I train with a bunch of people in Florida. And I'm going to drop a name that I was told never to drop, but I started with Kim Kahana, who was the original stunt school in Los Angeles, but he went to Florida. My first ever job was right behind that camera, right going into that Staples Center. We worked on a film called Like Mike back in the day. Mm. So that's how long ago that was. I think it was 2002. This is when he was little Bow Wow. This is before he became Bow Wow. So I've trained in New Orleans and at Yerkes and all these different places, but I picked up a little bit along the way. But one thing about stunts is, like, I wanted to be able to do the fire burn. My Facebook profile is me on fire.
And okay.
So I wanted to be able to do that. So if I ask, let's say you're going to act in my film, because you mentioned you've done acting before, or you're a stunt guy. If I'm going to ask you to do something, I want to have done it. So I'm not going to ask anybody to do anything that I'm not willing to do or I haven't done myself. So with that being said, I needed to learn the fire burn. So it could be safe. I usually have a coordinator there. I mean, I've never not had a coordinator there. And to be cost effective.
Yeah.
You know, they'll tell you it's worth a lot more sometimes than it really is, you know.
So you said your New Orleans project got you in trouble with the cops.
Yeah.
How did that go down?
Well, it's actually the opposite. So it was a pro cop film in New Orleans. So as you probably know, the city of New Orleans is a very liberal town. And I wasn't trying to be political or anything. I just thought to myself, man, I would love to do a documentary on the police. Like, I will go through, I don't even know if this is legal or not, speaking of laws, but I'd like to go through the process of being an NOPD officer and then work 1 week and quit just to see how bad it is. You know, I'm talking about the crime, not the police officers. You know, there's people say they're corrupt. They're not.
Couldn't you have just done that with a ride along?
I thought about it, I talk about me and my partner, Sheree Stewart. We were auditioning for everything, but there was one casting director in town that would not call us in for CIS New Orleans or NCIS New Orleans. So we were trying to get in with this casting director. So we was like, why don't we make a cop film, have everything that's within, you know, NCIS New Orleans, and that would be a showcase instead of me doing this documentary that might not lead anywhere. So it ended up being a pro police officer. Like, the idea was, man, these guys got a tough job in this area. There's like a murder seems like every day there. And it's a very, 300,000 people, 389,000 people. So with that being said, I did that. And what got me into trouble is we were on the front page. You know, I'm very, like, I'm centric. I don't even vote. I'm just gonna be honest with you, okay? What ends up happening is, a week after this releases, the Alton Sterling thing happens in Baton Rouge. Now, that Alton Sterling is when the Baton Rouge Police Department allegedly, I don't want to put anything for sure, but they killed this man. So it kind of goes against, and that's like, well, this guy's doing a pro-cop film, and, you know, and then they, you know, the blue stripe, and I was just like, this was created to try to get on NCIS New Orleans and, you know, to say, wow, man, this must be a tough job. And wouldn't you know, we had the screening at Valley Film Festival. There was a person at the Valley Film Festival that said to us, and I hope she's watching, but I said, why don't you guys audition for NCIS New Orleans? I said, we're trying. That's what this whole thing's about. She said, the casting director in New Orleans isn't the main person. There's a person over Paramount you need to send to. So we did. 1 week after returning, Sheree and I, my partner Sheree and I, who she was the other person in the film, both had auditions. Now, I didn't book it. Sheree booked it, and it was the only time she ever auditioned for that casting director in the 5 years that both of us were there. It was because of Protocol New Orleans. So it succeeded with what it was goal, is to get us in that door. And the kind of the backstory is like, man, this is a tough job. So, but that, when that came out in the local newspapers there, one of my things I mentioned about doing everything is I'm really good at doing press and press releases and I'm a publicist, basically. But I'm kind of a publicist and self-promoter for myself, as you can probably tell. And I'm able to get into all the newspapers in New Orleans because they don't know my tricks. That doesn't work here in Los Angeles. You know, I don't have Johnny Depp in my movie. They don't care. You know, you know the filmmaking stuff. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But those little tricks work in places like Oklahoma, New Orleans, Florida. Like, I can get, so when we got that kind of big press.
I've seen friends that have, like, minor little, you know, successes that, you know, like, we applaud them for, you know, yeah, you did a great thing. And they send things off to their hometown and they go a little overboard. And in fact, when I was a finalist in the Doritos Crash the Super Bowl competition, we played on that exact same thing.
Right.
Because three of us were from San Diego.
Yes.
So we contacted all the San Diego news organizations. We were on like three different news stations. And it was insane.
So San Diego is a perfect example because it's close enough to LA, but it's kind of out of that loop where you might be able to play some of the games and, you know, you make the press release, it's to somebody else. I mean, I'm giving all my tricks away, but the fact of the matter, you send it over through an AP wire, you know, those kind of things would put you in a scenario to get press. Sometimes I just call up and say, you know, the news desk, I got a book releasing. Okay, great. I mean, I'm just bringing them, and I already have everything pre-written. They can use my press release.
Yeah.
So for filmmaking, San Diego is a perfect example. I love San Diego, by the way. It's a great city. I love going down there for Comic-Con.
Yes.
I don't like the lines, but I just like hanging.
That's why I always avoid Hall H. I'm never. I do Comic-Con differently than a lot of other people do.
Okay.
I do Comic-Con for networking.
Yes.
I'm going down there to meet people and
that's exactly what I go.
To touch base with my contacts, to try and even pitch when appropriate.
Right.
You know, and
see what new technology is out there. Like I go to Monsterpalooza last week, it was just to see, you know, what different equipment's there. You know, maybe I'd hire somebody from there. I'm not a big autograph person or anything, but you know, it's just cool. Sometimes you might meet somebody who I saw Billy Zane with no line. Might have been a good time to go up to him and say,
"Oh wow!"
You know, it might have been
I'm trying to think too. Like when the last thing he did was, he was hot for a while. I mean, hot like business wise, not like attractive.
Right. Well,
I mean,
I get it.
Yeah, I get it too. I mean, he was attractive. You know.
Well, he's still a good looking guy. This guy was the main love interest, or I guess the bad guy in Titanic. You know, but he's not really. I
was surprised when a few years ago at Comic-Con, there was no line for Bruce Boxleitner.
Right. See, there you go.
And like that, like for me, I'm like, wait, this is Bruce Boxleitner.
Right.
You know.
And then you see somebody like, you know, like Doug Bradley, you know, or Pinhead. You know, it's a horror movie-centric thing. And now if you go up to an average person, they're going to know more about Billy Zane's movies than maybe Doug Bradley's. But as horror movie fans, he's got people out the door. It's not a way to judge anybody, but that might be the time to say, they always ask who's in your film. You know, like, yeah, have a name or whatever. I mean, he's he's a name. He's Titanic. I mean, he's on the poster.
Yeah.
You know, so, and that's if you want to make a film with him telling the story and he wants to do it. I don't know what his rate is, but you get my point, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And,
hustling.
And I mean, it's all about hustling.
For
the feature I've been trying to do, you know, it's like, I knew I couldn't immediately go after the big names I wanted, so I started going after some of the small ones, and I was able to get Jeffrey Combs attached.
Okay. Wow, yeah. And I like him a lot. In fact, for my film, Samurai Priest, Live Evil, we had a choice between Jeffrey Combs. Well, not a choice, but we had three people we were looking at.
Right.
James Hong. He had a Balls of Fury at the time. He didn't want to do it. He just actually got a star in a Walk of Fame. I did a movie with him in 2003 in Florida. Ken Frey, who ended up being in it, and then Jeffrey Combs, who I like Jeffrey Combs, but I was like, don't bug him because I don't know if this is right for him, but I like him a lot. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like we were looking at those three. The guy that I worked with, one of the producers, knew all three. I knew James Hong, knew the two, I knew the third guy. And we ended up going with Ken Frey because he's more of the Dawn of the Dead horror movie guy, you know, and I think he fit it the best. But anyways, that's another great point. So you never know.
Well, and it was like sometimes you got to do like what it takes too. Like, you know, going, especially if you're trying to get attachments, but you don't have funding secured yet.
Oh.
Because the agents don't want to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I lucked out with him because his agents are his lawyers. And they just said, it'll be this amount to get him attached and have
great.
His name for a year. And I was like, literally, it was like I didn't have much more than what they were asking, but I was like, I will pay that.
Yeah.
But I said, as long as he reads the script, or at least his scenes, and likes it.
Right.
I at least had to have that, and it wasn't just them going, oh, here's, you know, his name for a thing. I at least had to get it. And like a week or two later, they're like, hey, he loves it. He's willing to be in it. Once you get your funding, here's your thing. Send me my money.
Right, yeah, they want the money.
Like once you send the money,
yeah.
It wasn't a lot, but it was nothing.
It was
because they didn't know me.
Right.
And because I don't have a huge feature track record yet, I had to bring something to the table.
Yeah.
And I was, I think, lucky that they were willing to have that conversation with me and let me do that. Whereas most agents, like I was trying to get another actor from The Walking Dead on, and they completely blew me off.
Right.
And I was even, I even shouldn't have done it, but I was even like, well, I'm willing to pay a fee.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, I don't think he would do that, but go ahead and make an offer. And I'm kind of like, you know what? I don't want him that bad.
Right. Like, I'll give you a perfect example to go along with what you're saying. I'll just drop the name because I don't care. I mean, it doesn't matter. We were going to try to get Rutger Hauer for a while. Okay. Now, at this point, he had done a film called Goal 3. This is before he went back and did Batman.
Okay.
And it's before he did Hobo with a Shotgun. So he was doing some of these kind of weird, you know, children's films and this and that. And he's still Rutger Hauer. I mean, obviously, rest in peace now. He's passed away. But with that being said, his agent said, I told him our budget of our film, which at that time was in excess of $500,000. Not a made-up budget, not something that, you know, you could check the SAG records, yada, yada. With that being said, he said that our budget was not his day rate. And I was like, well, that's a little ridiculous. So sometimes what these agents will do, and as you probably know, and I'm just saying this for anybody who watches, they're not going to even show it to them because they're going to try to parasite for as much as they want. And I'm like, well, what if Rutger Hauer wanted to do it?
Which is their job.
Yeah,
they're supposed
fine.
To get their client as much money as possible.
But what if, I mean, Rutger Hauer ended up doing Hobo with a Shotgun, which I love, but, like, would he not have fit for this, too? I mean, at least run it by him. And they didn't even, you know, they weren't even having it. And
I remember...
He ended up in Batman, maybe not a bad decision.
I remember
so.
Years ago being attached to a script back when I thought I was a producer.
Okay.
And I was trying to get Stacey Keach for one of the roles.
Yeah, okay, sure.
And I went to his agent, and... it was back before you would email scripts to them.
Okay.
And it was like I had to send the paper script.
Ugh.
And so I sent the paper script, and I called the follow-up, and he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And then he kind of like lifts some stuff up. He's like, oh, I see it here. Yeah, we'll get back to you. Like, and of course I never.
Yeah,
I never.
It was like...
Because I didn't have the money. You know,
right.
You had to have something to play ball, but it's that old catch-22. You got to have... some of the funding to get the attention. You got to get the attention to get the fund, you know.
Well, in the scenarios that I'm talking about with Hong or with any of these people, we had the funding. It was like, give us a number that you know, what does he cost? Like, I never found out what Rutger Hauer's day rate was. If they would have came to us and said, listen, he's 50 grand a day, you know, and we need him for 12 days. Okay, that's not going to happen. Yeah. But if they said, hey, listen, we're going to get him for the duration of this film and we'll just give you a flat fee, I mean, maybe that works. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, like, they weren't interested. They had bigger fish to fry because they wanted to make more money. I mean, let's just say an actor's day rate is $10,000.
Yeah.
What are they going to make, $1,000? I mean, that's not even to keep on the light. So I understand with them, with their point of view, especially if they're SAG, get 10%. It's not really even worth it for them. And if it's even less, it's even less money. So, you know, there we go. So, I mean, I get it from their point of view, but I don't know. I just wanted a better blow off.
Yeah.
You know, I guess.
Well, this has been a great conversation.
Yeah.
I think it's going to give a lot of our, you know, listeners and the filmmakers, our alumni, you know, a different perspective as they're approaching their next projects.
Yeah. And hey, nice meeting you. I love hearing about your films and, you know, hit me up. It's and I'll tell this to you if you watch it back. It's Mark Terry Online. Anything Mark Terry Online
on
Facebook.
Yeah, where can people find you? Mark Terry Online.
MarkTerryOnline.com. SamuraiPriest.com will be coming. I mean, I don't know if this is the place to say it, but I did a children's book called Kyle the Coyote, which is out now. That released in April. That's on KyleTheCoyote.com. But really, anything Mark Terry online, you'll find me. And if I'm on fire, if my body's on fire, that's me. I mean, but you know what? I'll tell you this real quick. There is a Mark Terry out there, and he's older than me. He directed Man in the Iron Mask, and I spoke to him. He's Canadian. So every once in a while they get me, but he did some movie about Antarctica.
Okay.
That is not me. I've never been to Antarctica. I've been to New Orleans, maybe that's in the middle of nowhere too, but that's where you can find me.